Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Mem Tet Amud Aleph, four lines down. Yibayluhu, machar kol nechasav, mahu. He sells all of his property, all of his possessions. What is the din? So until now we spoke about his shchimira, who's gifting all of his property. And in giving away or gifting all of his property, we have an underlying assumption, an umdan and a dat, that he's only doing this because he thinks he's going to pass away. And therefore, if he survives and does not pass away, the transaction is reversed. On the other hand, if he's machar kol nechasav, if he sells everything that he owns, sells all of his possessions, so you can look at that in one of two ways. He's selling all of his possessions because he wants to liquidate everything before he dies, ease the burden on his inheritors. Or you just say that he thinks it's a good time to liquidate all of his assets, doesn't necessarily have to be connected to his death. The question then becomes, can he reverse that position? If he survives and does not pass away, was the sale premised on his death? Or was the sale a sale irrespective of his death? That's what Gemara is asking the question. Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, imamad inu chuzer. If he survives, he doesn't have a right of retraction. Vizimnin, Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, imamad chuzer. Sometimes Rav Yehuda would give the opposite psak, that if he survives, chuzer, he is able to retract the sale. So we have Amar Yehuda Marav, who seems to have a safek or be vacillating on this din, as to whether when you sell it, it's classified like a matnat shchemira. Velo plige, the Gemara says, no. It wasn't that he wasn't certain about the din, but rather has to do with the nature of what he does with the money. Ha, dit nihu lezuzei beinayu. That is if the money is still extant, it's still here. Ha, de parino bechovo. And the other case is where he used the money to pay off his debts. So whether the Rashbam reads it is that if he's paying off his debts with the sale of the property, then that's irrespective of his dying. He wants to relieve himself of those debts. And so he sells the property to relieve himself of the debt. That would be equally applicable whether he passes away or he doesn't pass away. He wants to rid himself of those debts. And therefore, it is a binding sale whether he survives or does not survive. On the other hand, if he has the cash in hand and he still has the cash around, we assume that he simply liquidated it in order to have this ease the burden on the Yorshim or make it more easily divisible amongst the Yorshim. And therefore, the money being around is an indication that he only intended to do this because of his death. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says, Shalohotzian. He didn't spend the money because he knew that he might have to reverse the sale. Adat kein machran. He sold on that condition. She'im yamod yachzor ben. The fact that he kept the money is indicative of the fact that he might want to reverse the sale. If he didn't intend to reverse the sale, he would have spent the money. He would have done other things with the money. The fact that he saved it shows you that he is not certain that this sale will be permanent. He might want to reverse the sale afterwards. Or you could just simply say that the security of owning property in their day, real property, was the equivalent of putting it into the bank or a deposit box versus holding cash, which was very risky in those days, as it is today. The more cash that you have, the more at risk you are for it being stolen or for it being taken. You want to keep it in a secure location or a secure asset. The fact that he liquidated the property and now is holding cash in his house, that doesn't seem to be a good decision. Elim Kane, he thinks he's going to pass away. If he's not going to pass away, there's no reason to liquidate all your deposits and bring them into a risky cash in your house. So that means that it's obviously in his mindset that he wants to reverse the transaction. That is the view, the Rashbam, the Rabbeinu Gershom, and many of the Rishonim. The Rimi Gash and the Yad Ramo over here, actually learn the Gemara the exact opposite and say that if he used the monies to pay down the debts, then it's a reversible transaction. If he keeps the cash around, then it's an irreversible transaction. That is because of the principle that we had before, which is that a shchimera that liquidates all of his assets, gives away all of his assets, then it's clear that he doesn't believe he's going to survive. Then if he withholds assets or he keeps things behind, that means that he might have considered or thought about the fact he might survive. And that's why he's holding back assets. And that's what they describe here. In the case where he pays down the debts, then he has nothing left. He took all of his assets and he put them to pay off the debts. And now there's nothing left in the estate. So that's an indication that he thought he was going to pass away because he has nothing to use or utilize afterwards. So if he has money left over, then that might not be true. But if he keeps the money around, then the estate still has assets, or that he is relying on those assets in order to survive afterwards. And that means that whatever he did was done permanently, and he kept the money because he thought he might survive. And that means it's the equivalent of a matnat shkimeimra b'miktzat, which is an irreversible transaction. So they view the Gemara just the opposite, the way the Rishbam, the Rabbeinu Gershom, read it in the Lo Plige, and their reading of the Gemara lines up or aligns more along the lines of the quotes from Yehuda. Because the first quote from Yehuda is Amad Eino Chuzer, that you don't have a right of retraction, and the first answer in the Lo Plige is Hadit Niluzuze Be'enayu. That's when the money is there. So that would indicate that the two are probably connected, although there are places in the Gemara where it reverses it. That might have been what influenced them to give their pshat, aligning the positions that were brought to Rabbi Yehuda along with the reasons afterwards as to why he's not arguing. Ibayluhu. Next question is, Shchiv Meira Shehudeh Mahu. Shchiv Meira that admits to something, what is the din? So this is a general principle that we know from Shas. We actually discussed it earlier in the Masechta, that Hodat Baldin, a person who makes an admission, that is the equivalent of 100 edim, and a person can obligate themselves through hoda'ah, through an admission. We discussed earlier in the Masechta, back in Daf Lamed Gimel, as to why hodat baldin kemei edami works. What is the mechanism for it working? You have the possibility, the Rashbam over there brought that it was a matana, that since you can give it as a gift, therefore migo, you could give it as a gift, you're believed to say whatever it is. We have the Sod HaChoshen that quotes Rashi in Kedushin that it's a gzera to katuf. We have others that say that the whole problem of karov and why you're not believed about yourself is because you're a nogea badavar. But when it's to your detriment, you can't claim that it's nogea badavar because it's not something that is to your benefit or something that is, we'd be suspicious of you not telling the truth. There's also the possibility that it was a chaticha sheli sura, that he makes it the equivalent of when someone declares something treif, even though others don't, we have edim against it, you're not allowed to eat that food, because you declared it treif for yourself. You make that item into isur. Same thing over here, that if you declare that this money or this property belongs to someone else, you then have restricted yourself from engaging in it because it's on your own declaration. For whatever the reason is, as we discussed back there, the hoda'ah of a baldin is as if mea edim and is binding on that individual. And there, the Gemara discusses that hodat baldin is so strong, it's strong enough to overcome other edim. Even if you have edim testifying to the contrary, your hoda'ah will obligate yourself, irrespective of what the edim are saying against you. And that's how powerful this idea of hodat. So over here, we have a shchiv meira who is declaring some property of his to belong to another party, or saying that this money I gave to so-and-so, he is saying that whatever possession it is belongs to another party. The question is now, is that binding? Why wouldn't it be binding? Why should a shchiv meira be any different than a bari? If you have a hoda'ah, then the hoda'ah by definition obligates you to do whatever you dictated. And over here, since he's going to pass away, we're going to do whatever he said. Why shouldn't we carry out his hoda'ah? The Rashbam brings up a case from Sanhedrin, and through that case in Sanhedrin explains what's going on over here. The Gemara in Sanhedrin has an issue where an individual is a shchiv meira, and he says that I owe money to so-and-so, that so-and-so is a creditor to me and I owe him money. Over there, the Gemara says, do we listen to him? Do we believe him when he says that? And the Gemara concludes over there, umaskana, adam asui shalol hazbia et banav. Person has an impetus to, quote-unquote, lie in these situations and say he owes money to people, even though he doesn't really owe money to them. Upturim ilishalim. And therefore the Yorshim do not have to pay those debts back. Because the assumption is the reason he's doing this is to detract from the size of his estate or detract from the size of his wealth. Which is that he is now gifting the money to his children, the estate is moving to his children. And he doesn't want people to think either that his children are very wealthy or that there's a huge estate that's passing. Maybe there's a tax issue. Whatever the reasons are, he doesn't want people to think the estate is so big. So he goes out and declares that I owe money to this person, I owe money to that person, so that the assets of the estate all of a sudden don't seem so big because there are all these creditors that have a claim against the estate. So the Gemara there says we don't believe him because we believe the reason he's doing this is to, quote unquote, reduce his wealth. It may be to prevent an ayin hara, or other reasons that he might be doing this. That is true by a milveh, by a loan. The reason is that nobody admits that they owe money, Because then it's Eved Lobe Le Ish Malve. Person is encumbering themselves in that case to the Malve. People don't want to put themselves in that position or won't put themselves in that position. And for that reason, we assume that he's not telling the truth. But over here, it's not a case of Milve, but a case of Pikadon. It's a case where he says that whatever that property is belongs to so-and-so. Or that money that I have over there belongs to so-and-so. He deposited it with me. Or I gave it to him, Ayudei Acher. So here the declaration is a little different. The declaration is not, I owe money. Rather, the declaration is that it's a Pikadon that belongs to so-and-so. And that's the nature of the question, which is that by the case of Milve, we say, Vadai Lachzik Atzmo Ke'ani. He definitely wants to make himself look poor. Hayal said, that's why he does it. Aval. Kevin Shamamon Be'ein V'hu Modeh Shoplonihu. In our case, where we're not talking about an debt or a creditor where he's saying that I owe money or I owe this. Over here he's talking about a physical asset, which he's declaring belongs to someone else. So maybe over there, Yishlomar, Shiv Gido Etzlo Mikodem Lezeh. Hashchemira, that maybe this was something that the Shchemira had deposited, he's telling the truth. Ohikno lo Shchemira yidei acher, or he gave it to him through another party. And maybe he really wants it to go to this party. So over here, we're uncertain as to whether the hoda'ah, this admission, is the same type of admission by the debt, which is that he's just trying to reduce, quote unquote, the assets of the estate, make himself look poor, or is this a different type of admission? Over here, we're talking about an asset that is intact. Not saying that I have debts or some sort of intangible item that makes it that there's a claim against the estate. He's literally saying that there are assets of the estate belong to so-and-so. Maybe that's really what he's trying to do, is to clear this out, to say that this really belongs to that person. So that's the nature of the question according to the Rashbam. And is, do we extrapolate from the din of Milveh to the din of Pikadon? Similar to what the Rabbeinu Gershom says over here, Odilma lohachi kamar hachi, shim yamod mechol yo al yachshavu b'nei adam shu ashir. If he survives this sickness, people won't think that he's rich. Shemishel acherim hu velo kani, because it belongs to other people, and therefore there's no kinyan over here. So as the Rashbam says that the father's doing it in order to make it that the children are rich, or that there's no ayin ara, according to the Rabbeinu Gershom, he's doing this in order for people not to think that he's wealthy. And that if he survives here, they're not going to think that he's this super wealthy individual. But it's the same concept or idea, which is that he's trying to hide his wealth, whether it's he's hiding his wealth for the benefit of his children, or he's hiding his wealth for himself. That's the nature of the question of the Gemara over here, is whether this hoda'ah is simply doing that, or is this hoda'ah really obligating him, and he's being honest in this statement that he wants this to happen. Over here, the Balei Tosafot say, V'ein nirat lomar, says that doesn't make any sense. Da'ah d'rabba. It's just the opposite. There's more likely that a person is telling the truth by a loan than he is by a pikadon. By milve, as we said before, the logic is eved lo vele ish malve. When you encumber yourself in a debt situation, that is detrimental because you put yourself in a difficult or poor position because creditors always have the upper hand in these situations. If you admit that you have an outstanding loan or an outstanding debt, that's something already which indicates you must be telling the truth, because nobody would do that unless it was really true. And there we say, it doesn't matter, and we say that he's just doing it to reduce the appearance of his assets, then certainly by Pikadon, we would say the same thing. That's number one. Number two is, he says that the Gemara here is about to bring a proof, and the proof doesn't seem to be associated with the question that the Rashbam indicates that the Gemara is asking. Therefore, the Balei Tosafot say, V'nir l'ri, V'reish kein, D'shchimira sholdeh mahu. D'shchimira admits to something, what do we view this as? So even though from everything we know, this doesn't belong to the other party, do we say now that his hoda'ah is the equivalent of a matnat shchimira? Do we view this as another mechanism for the shchimira to give away property? Until now, we assumed that this property belonged to him, and there's no evidence to the contrary. And in all likelihood, he's maybe not even telling the truth. But we allow hoda'ah is an obligation. But is hoda'ah here functioning like a matnat shchemira? And that means that if he passes away, it'll go through. But if he survives, he can reverse it. Or do we say that the hoda'ah over here is working like it does everywhere else in Shas, which is that he's simply hoda'at badin kamei adam dami? That means that he's chayav. Doesn't matter whether he survives, doesn't survive. It's a hoda'ah, not a matnat shchemira. And that's the question of the Gemara. Is Hoda'ah Matnat Shemira? Or is Hoda'ah Hodat Baldin? And so those are the two possibilities according to the Baalei Tosafot, and that's the nature of the question of the Gemara over here. And then he said, Be'od Yesh Mifarshim, the Tosafot brings a third possibility as to what the question is, that he admits that he has a pikadon with a third party. But he says, I gave it away to someone else. So in that case, Mimahani Laknoto Ba'amira Ba'alma. Is he successful at granting that ownership by simply saying so? Although, or it does not work that way. So here you have three different possibilities as to what the question is that the Gemara is asking. According to the Reshbam, the question is that we know by Milveh, if a person says, I owe money as a Shchimira, we don't believe him. We think that he's just doing it to make himself look poor. Do we say the same thing by Pikadon? And that's the question over here. According to the Baalei Tosafot, is Hoda'ah a type of Matnat Shchemera? Or is it Hoda'ah like Kol HaTorah Kula, which is just an obligation? And then the third shot, which the Tosafot doesn't love, but it is brought by other Rishonim as well, is if he has a deposit with a third party, and he says, I'm granting that deposit to someone else, does that work as a Matnat Shchemera? Can that Hoda'ah, when the item is sitting with another party, function to move it? His amira sufficient to move that from the shomer, the nifkad, the one who's holding on to the pikadon, to transfer out of his possession into the possession of the recipient? And that'd be the nature of the question of shkiv mira, that is hodeh, mahu, what is the din over here? Now the Gemara brings a story in order to answer the question. Tashma, the isur guyura, isur the ger, havalei treser alfei suze beirova. He had 12,000 zuz in Rava's house. Rav Mari Berei, Rav Mari's son, Horato Shalobik Dusha, was conceived before he had converted. But he was born once Isur Giura had already converted. Obey Rav Havra, and Rav Mari was out learning in the Beit Midrash. He is obviously Rav Mari, he is a Talmud Chacham, but he was busy in the Beit Midrash. He wasn't near his father, Isur Giura. The story or the background to this is found in the Gemara in Ketubot. Rav Mari is known as Rav Mari Bar Rachel. The reason he's known by his mother's name is not his father's name is because his father was Isur Giura. Isur Giura was a non-Jew when he was conceived. Isur Giura was a captor that took the daughters of Shmuel into captivity. And while in captivity, the daughters of Shmuel end up marrying their captors. One of the daughters, Rachel, married Isur Giura, and then became pregnant before he converted. So that's what it means here. Rav Mari was conceived before Isur Giura converted. Later on, Isur Giura converts before he's born. Rav Mari, of course, is Jewish because his mother is Jewish. It's just the question what his relationship is to his father. When he was conceived, his father was not Jewish. When he's born, his father is Jewish. But even once his father was Jewish, is there any relationship between Isur Giura and Rav Mari? We have the principle, which is that Ger Shenitz Gayer Ketinok Shenola Domi. That means that once a Ger converts, he's as if he's a newborn. And his existing biological relationships all terminate, and he has no halachic relationship with those individuals. So that means that technically Isur Giura and Rav Mari are not related at all. Even though he's the biological father of Rav Mari, he is not necessarily the halachic father of Rav Mari because of the fact that he was non-Jewish when Rav Mari was conceived. So now that is the background to the story here. Tosafot is loath to accept what the Rishbam says, that these are the same individuals. Rav Mari Berei is associated with Rav Mari Bar Rachel, that is mentioned other places in Shas, being the daughter of Shmuel and the whole story with the captivity, because of two reasons. One of which is that Rav Mari Bar Rachel was a Kulo Mi'Israel, that both of his parents were Jewish because his father had converted. So that would imply that it wasn't like here where he was Horato Shalobik Dusha and Leidato Bik Dusha. And number two is, in the case in Tubot, the daughters of Shmuel show up at the Beit Midrash. They leave their captors outside and go into the Beit Midrash and say that we were taken into captivity, Bitohorimanu, and we are to Horim. And based on that declaration, we say, Peshe Asur, Peshe Hitir, and Rabbi Chanina was matir them and said that they did not have the suspicions of a normal Shvuya who might have been taken advantage of by the captor. Based on that, Tosfot says they were telling the truth. They weren't lying about that. And since they weren't lying about that, why would you say over here that she already had had Bia with Isur Geura and become pregnant prior to his conversion? That means that what they said in the Beit Midrash was not true. What the Rashbam will say is that's exactly what they were doing. The reason they were smart, and that's what the Gemara says over there, is they left their captors outside and they came in and made the declaration in order to free themselves, even though that may not have been the halacha. They knew that that would be the halachic outcome if they did it in this manner. But for those reasons, Tosafot wants to disassociate the Rav Mori here from the Rav Mori Bar Rachel that's found in other places in Shas. And he simply says that the Rav Mori Bar Rachel in those cases was not because of his father being Isur Geura, and not because his father was a convert, but rather because they wanted to have the Yichus go back to Shmuel. And so there was Rav Mori Bar Rachel, who was the daughter of Shmuel, and for that, to have his Yichus connected to Shmuel, it had to go through his mother. So that's why they're miyaches him to his mother, not like Rashi says in Shas, or the Rashbam says over here. It's because he was born from Isur Geura, was a ger, and therefore they were miyaches him to his mother. Amar Rava, Rava says here that he as the shomer that is watching these 12,000 zuz on behalf of Isur Geura. He says, Heicha nikninu Rav Mari lahane zuzei. How is Rav Mari going to come into possession of these items? Isur Geura is about to pass away. He's a shchimera. And a ger that passes away, we know that all of his assets are hefker. Rav is looking at this and saying, the money is in my possession. And if Isur Geura passes away and he doesn't give it away before then I'm going to be the first in line to take possession of it because it literally is in my possession. So is there any way I can lose over here? Meaning that as things stand right now, if Isur Geura passes away, Rova is going to take possession of those 12,000 zuz. Is there any way that I could be disowned or disinherited from this money? So the one person or the one party that could possibly displace him is Rav Mori. Because Isur Geura, who is his biological father, might have a vested interest in seeing the money go to his son. So that would be the only thing that would have displaced him. So that's what Rava starts to think. In halachic terms, how is it possible for Isur Geura to get this money to his son, Rav Mori, and therefore prevent me from taking possession of it? Your question is a fair question, and it is a very, very difficult underlying leitmotif in the sugya, which is, why is Rava holding on to the money? He really should have been giving it to Rav Mori, irrespective of the halachic outcome here. He knows that the right outcome should be that it goes to Rav Mori. So then why is he halachically trying to determine how it will stay with him, as if that's what he wants the outcome to be? So that's a fair question. I will try to address it in a couple of minutes. Tosafot addresses it from the halachic standpoint, but other Rishonim address it even from the shkafic standpoint as to what Rav is doing. I would just say before we get to the answers that it is difficult, and I don't think it's totally resolved, even in the answers given by the Mefarshim here, as to why Rava is going in this direction. Ibi Yerusha, if it has to do with inheriting, Lav Bar Yerusha, he's not an inheritor. Rav Mori, halachically, is not the son of Isur Geura, because Isur converted, and then there's no connection between the two parties. Had Isur first converted, and then had Rav Mori, then it wouldn't have been an issue. Then he's definitely his son, and they are related, because it happened after he was already Jewish. Problem here is that that happened prior to his being Jewish, and therefore, there is no relationship between the two of them, at least halachically. And so Yerusha is not going to be the vehicle for passing this to Rav Mori. The Rashbam says that ger la barurutehu, when it comes to a ger, he's not an inheritor. The Rachmana afkere the zare dovei kochavim. Because the Torah released or disconnected the offspring of an ovei kochavim from himself. It's an interesting reason why the Rashbam brings that there's no connection between Isur Geura and Rav Mori. The easier answer, or the easier way to express it, is simply that Ger Shenit Gayer Ketinok Shenola Dami. But he says it in another way, which is that it's because he's a Goy, and the Goy therefore does not have a relationship with the child. Which is much more difficult, because a Goy does have a relationship with their children, at least with regards to Yerusha. We already learned that earlier, that we brought Psukim from Nach, that showed that a Goy does have a din of Yerusha from his father. And that there is a concept of Yerusha even amongst Goyim, even if there's no Yichus that connects them. That might be what Rashbam is hinting at over here, which is that the disconnect here is not because a Goy has no relationship to his child, but over here where the child is Jewish and he is a goy, maybe there's a disconnect in the relationship. So now how is he going to get it to his son Rav Mari? He's going to give it in a gift. But not Shchimira, the Rabbonon classified it as if it is Yerusha. We saw that in yesterday's daf as well. That Matnat Shchimira functions like Yerusha. Some of the nafkaminot are the fact that it only takes effect or is effective after the death of the individual, similar to Yerusha. And so that it is a mechanism that works just like Yerusha. And here, b'choi checha de'ita b'Yerusha, ita b'matana. If you are in the world of Yerusha, you're in the world of gifting. Koecha de leita b'Yerusha, if you're not in the world of Yerusha, leita b'matana. Then you're not in the world of matana. So here the Ramban and some of the other Rishonim believe that this has to do with the particular relationship that you're in. It's not talking about in general, if you're not in Yerusha, then you're not in Matnat Shchemira, because a Matnat Shchemira can be given to a third party. Doesn't have anything to do with direct Yerusha. It's specifically about this case where a child whose relationship to their father halachically does not exist, in that case, if there is no Yerusha between what is normally a relationship between a father and son, then Matnat Shchemira will also not work in that particular case. And it's really premised on the din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, which is that whether you use a Lashon Yerusha or a Lashon Matana, that's the way that you gift to inheritors or to children. But that means that it's working under the rubric of Yerusha. So therefore, in a case where a father and a son don't have that relationship of Yerusha, then they don't have that ability to have the Matnat Shchemira take effect. But that's unique to their relationship. It doesn't preclude them from being a recipient or a bequeather of a Matnat Shchemira to other parties. It's unique to these two parties, a father and a son, where Yerusha is the main mechanism of granting ownership. And so therefore, Matana or Yerusha works in that case from Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka as an enhancement to what is already existing as Yerusha. But if the underlying Yerusha doesn't exist, then in that case, we won't have the Matnat Shchemira take effect. Because, like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that, whether you say B'Lashon Yerusha Matana, it functions like Yerusha in that case, where that person is the rightful Yoresh to you. And therefore, the Matnat Shchemira is under that rubric of Yerusha, and that's why it won't function in this particular case. Because here, Matnat Shchemira is subsumed under Yerusha, and since Yerusha doesn't work, neither does Matnat Shchemira. But then it's uniquely limited to the cases where the person is a rightful Yoresh. On the other hand, most Rishonim believe, you can see that here in the Rashbam and in the Balei Tosafot, that this is a general principle, which is that if this individual is not in the world of Yerusha, then they are not in the world of Matnat Shchemira. That means that they can't be a recipient or a grantor of Matnat Shchemira, because they're not in the Parshia of Yerusha. It's expressed in two different ways. You can see this in the Rashbam. The Rashbam says that the Lete b'Yerusha, that he doesn't have anything to do with Yerusha, could go in Rav Mori. Lete nami b'din Matnat Shchemira. So the Rashbam views the person who is pivotal here is the recipient. If the recipient is not part of the world of Yerusha, then he's not part of the world of Matnat Shchemira, and he can't receive gifts as a Matnat Shchemira. And he gives Rav Mari as the example that Rav Mari is not in the world of Yerusha because of that severed relationship with his father, and maybe also because of the fact that he was Horata Shalom B'Kedusha, and then he was born B'Kedusha. So for both of those reasons, Rav Mari is outside the Parsha of Yerusha, and therefore he can't be a recipient of Yerusha. Since he's not a recipient of Yerusha, he's also not able or capable of being a recipient of Matnat Shchemira. The Balei Tosafot actually formulated just the opposite way. He says in the Tosafot called Ita B'Yerusha, nearly, Dim Hayu Lo Ager Banim Ita B'Matnat Shchemira. If the Ger has children, then he has a possibility of Matnat Shchemira. Afagav Amikabel Ger Delete B'Yerusha. Even though the ger is the recipient, doesn't have a din Yerusha. Dalanotenu deika kpeda v'lo amikabel. Doesn't matter who the recipient it is, it's the gifter that matters over here. So Tosfot says the gifter is the determining factor. If the gifter can be morish, then the gifter can also give a matnat shchemira, even if the recipient is a ger. On the other hand, the Rashbam views it the other way around, that it has to be the recipient that is in the world of Yerusha in order to accept a matnat shchemira. But both of them believe that this is a generic position, which is that person Can't get a matnas shivra from anybody. They're outside this world, the matnas shivra, period. It's not in this particular relationship, as the Ramban said, but rather it's a global fact or status for them that they are incapable of being involved in matnas shivra. So again, the Rashbam sees it as deriving from the recipient, whereas the Tosafot sees it as deriving from the gifter. So then, based on that, he says there's no matnas shivra that's going to happen over here because he's not in the world of Yerusha. In this case, it happens to be both of them, meaning that both Iser Giura is not in the world of being Morish because he was a Ger that converted. If he had children afterwards, then according to Tosafot, he would have come into the world of being a Morish. But at this point, he didn't have children after he converted. So therefore, he's not a Morish. And Rav Mari is not in the world of being Yorish because he doesn't have a father that can pass him Yerusha. And so given that, it's from both directions you have it in this case. That's obviously what leads to the difference of opinion here, according to the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot, as to which of the two parties here is pivotal. But that is what generates the problem of Matnat Shechemira, which functions like Yerusha. And for that reason, there is no Matnat Shechemira in this case. So next option. Ibn Mishicha. So what do you want to do? A Kinyan Mishicha? Let Nehu Gabe. You can't do a Kinyan Mishicha because the money's with me, Rabbah says, not with Iser Giura. So there's no way to enable a Kinyan Mishicha. Rav Mari is in the Beit Midrash, so he's nowhere near the money to take possession of the money. The Iser Giura doesn't have the money in his possession where he could give it to a third party to accept on behalf of his son. So a physical Kinyan is not going to work over here because the money is with Rava. Ibi Chalipin. So why don't you do a representative Kinyan, which is a Kinyan Sudar. So there you don't need a physical Kinyan, you do a representative Kinyan where by Yisr Giura will receive a Sudar in exchange for passing the money to his son, Rav Mari. And in that way, you'll do a Kinyan Sudar. That we already know from Boba Metzia, Ein Matbea Nikneh B'Chalipin. There is no such thing as a Kinyan Chalipin by Matbea, by coins. Money is not subject to Kinyan Chalipin. Kinyan Sudar doesn't work by money. It only works by objects or assets, not by currency. All right, so next, Iagav Karka. So let him do a Kinyan Agav. Kinyan Agav says that if I have real property, I can grant you other assets along with the real property as a mechanism for acquisition. The Mishnah in Kiddushin that says that non-real property can be acquired along with real property. So let him grant the real property to his son, Rav Mari. And along with that real property, he'll grant the ownership of the 12,000 zuz. Late Le'ara. He has no property. Iser Giura had no property, so he wasn't worried about that. The Balei Tosafot, they ask over here, this is based on the Balei Tosafot. We've seen it together in the Gemara in Ketubot. We saw it early in the Masechta here in Baba Batra. The Balei Tosafot say that you can create a Kinyan Agav by simply admitting that you have property. We don't go and check whether you really have land or don't have land. If you say, I have land, and I'm giving you that land to use as a Kinyan Agav, we don't go with a microscope and look and see whether you really do have land or not. We just assumed if you say you have land, and you're giving this acquisition to the person Agav that karka, we say that's a hoda'ah, and that hoda'ah should work. Just like a hoda'ah works, in this case, to obligate oneself or to make it into a Kinyan, it works to create a Kinyan Agav. So Balei Tosafot said, why can't Iser Giura just use a Kinyan Agav by saying, I have land, and I'm giving that land to my son Rav Mari, and with that land, I'm giving the money. And the Balei Tosafot concluded, Eino Chanami, it would have worked. Had he done that, it would have been successful. He just didn't know. Iser Giura just wasn't aware of the fact that you could do something like that. Ibn Mamad Shloshtam, the Kedin that we saw yesterday, which is Mamad Shloshtam, is that if you have the Malve, Love, and the party that you want to transfer it to all together, then you can transfer the ownership or the rights of the collection of the creditor. So over here, if you have a Mafkid, Nifkad, and the recipient, then if the three of them are together, the Mafkid should be able to tell the Nifkad to give that to party number three, and it should work. Says, Ishalach Leilo Azilna. Says, that has to be done face to face. And if he asks me to come over, I'm not going to go over there because that way you can't accomplish the Mamad Shloshtam. In terms of reading this, this is probably the most problematic of the statements because here it's clear that Rava is trying to prevent or is not cooperating in terms of allowing the money to pass from Iser Giura to Rav Mari. So there he says, by Mamad Shloshtam, if he calls for me, I'm not going to go. This does lead to a machloket in the Mishonim as to what Mamad Shloshtam requires. Does Mamad Shloshtam require just face-to-face? Or does it also require acquiescence? Meaning that all the parties have to be willing participants. And that means that Rava could stop it just simply by the fact that he is not interested in doing the Mamad Shlashtom. He's saying no, and it doesn't work. Even if he went, maybe it could be prevented by him saying no, and that's what he's saying over there. Lo Azilna, I'm not interested in going, I'm not going to allow for this to happen. Although, from the wording in the story here, it makes it sound more like the fact that had he showed up, he would have been compelled to do the Mamad Shlashtom, and that's why Rava didn't want to go over there. Or, it might have been that if Rava went over there, he would have felt compelled to acquiesce to whatever Isra said, and therefore he didn't want to go, and he still would need the acquiescence of all three parties in order to make it an effective Mamad Shlashtam. So now, at that point, he's basically gone through all the halachic possibilities and says that none of them are going to work over here. I'm going to get to keep the money when Isra Giura passes away. The question Tosfot asked is, what's going on over here? Why is it that Rava is trying to prevent the money from going to Rav Mari and trying to keep it for himself? So Tosfot asks over here, Vim Tomar, Halove Ma'ot min Ovid Kochavim, Shinitgaru Banaf, a person who borrowed money from an Ovid Kochavim whose children converted, Lo Yachzir LeBanav, after the Ovid Kochavim passes away, he shouldn't return it to the children. Vim Yachzir, if he returns it, Ein Ruach Chachamim Nochal Menu. The Chachamim are not happy with that. Vahatanyo, and we have an alternate bright that says, Ruach Chachamim Nochal Menu. That he pays back money to the children, then that is a positive thing. My answer is, Lo Kasha. That depends on if he was conceived and born non-Jewish. Here's a case where he's conceived when he was non-Jewish, but was born when he was already Jewish. So, Im Kain, Ayalola Rova Lachzir. This seems like exactly the same case here. Rav Mari is Horato Shalo Bik Dusha and Leidato Bik Dusha. And for that reason, he should be obligated to return it at this point. So why isn't he returning the money to him? It seems like the Gemara even addresses this case exactly and says that Ruach Chachamim no chaymenu. The Teretz Rabbeinu Tam. So the Rabbeinu Tam gave an answer. Kevin she'asa lo'ovid kochavim chesed. Since the Kochavim did a goodness to him, a tova to him, she'ilvalo, because he lent him money in his time of need. Yase imo chesed v'itein the banav. Therefore, he wants to return the favor and he gives it to the children, even though he's not obligated to give it to the children. Avakan, shloaseim ochesed, sheif kidam etzla. Over here, Rava doesn't have that obligation. Rava was watching the money for Isra Giura. He didn't lend the money. Isra Giura wasn't lending the money to Rava. Rava owed nothing to Isra Giura. So in that case, since he owed nothing to Isra Giura, he doesn't have to do this chesed, ein tzarich lachzir lebanav. He doesn't have to give it back to the children. So it's an interesting technical answer that Tosafot gives, which is, normally we know that there's this severing of a relationship between the child and the parent in the conversion process. So we say if children convert and you had borrowed money from the non-Jewish father, then you don't have an obligation to pay the children because there's no connection between the father and the children. They're not halachic yoshim, so you don't have to pay them back. And they're the ein ruach chachamim menochamenu. The ruach chachamim is not happy if he does pay it back because there is no obligation to pay it back and we don't want him paying back. The exception to that rule, we said, is that if it was horatav shalobik dusha, behedledatobik dusha, if he was conceived when he was non-Jewish, the child, but born when he's Jewish, over there we do encourage you to pay it back and to give it to the children. Rabbeinu Tam says that's all premised on this idea that he lent you money, he did something good for you, you want to return the favor, so you gave it to the kids, even though you're not obligated to pay them. In our case over here, Rava doesn't have that obligation. Isra Giura didn't do the tova, it's actually the other way around. Rava's doing a tova for Isra Giura because he's keeping the money for him. And therefore, Rava owes nothing to Isra Giura, and that means that he's not obligated to give it his son, Rav Mari. That's how Tosafot learns. Then he brings from the Rivam, the Rabbeinu Tam's brother. So we had the Rabbeinu Tam, and now his brother, the Rivam, makes another suggestion, which is, Perish came into Lok Tani Behedja Bebraita, Vim Lo Yigzir Ein Ruach HaChamim No Chaymenu. Since it's not explicit in the Braita that it says, if you give it back, the Chachamim are happy. But it doesn't say, if you don't give it back, they're not happy. Lo Avachayish LaRava, Rava didn't worry about the Braita. And Tosfot says, Ve'ein Nira Klal. He says that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We do that all over Shas. If the Braita says that the Chachamim are happy when you do something, they're obviously unhappy when you don't do it. You don't need to have that written out explicitly. And therefore he rejects the answer of the Rivam, the Rabbeinu Tam's brother. But there are Rishonim who learn just the opposite, which is that the obligation to give it back is in a case when they're a complete gear, and not in a case where they're horatan, shalomik dushan, leidatamik dushan, and that's because we are worried about them going back the geyutan because of the money issue, which is that they're going to leave the faith because of their conversion now cause them to lose out on the Yerusha. Due to that fear, we give it back to them when they are complete geirim, whereas in a case where it is where he's Jewish anyway, and it has nothing to do with converting, over there, there's no obligation to give it back. And therefore, in this case, there would be no obligation to return the monies. Others mention that it is a seyag min hachachamim, so that people don't mistakenly believe that there is a relationship between the father and the child. And therefore, we don't want to give the money because we want to emphasize that the halacha is that there is no halachic relationship between these two parties. So Tosfot deals with the answer from simply a cold, halachic, practical manner, which says that Rav is under no obligation to give it to Rav Mari. And given the circumstances, he owes nothing to him as well. And therefore, halachically, he's free to take possession of the monies. The problem is that that only addresses the halachic issue, does not address the hashkafic moral issue over here of giving the money back. So there are Rishonim that come up with different reasons as to why Rav might not want to give it back here. The reason that might resonate the most is that Rav wanted it to be that he was returning the money out of a chesed and not mitzad din. Rav wanted to be able to accomplish giving the money to Rav Mari. He was going to give the money to Rav Mari in the end. Question was he obligated to give the money to Rav Mari because somehow there was a transference of ownership from Yisur Gyura to Rav Mari? Or was there no halachic way to get the money from Yisur Gyura to Rav Mari, and therefore when Rav gives it, it's an act of chesed on Rav's part? So that's all Rav was trying to clear over here was, is he going to be obligated to give the money to Rav Mari, or is he going to give the money to Rav Mari as an act of chesed? That is, to me, is the best answer that can be given in terms of what happened over here. I'm not sure that it reads so easily into what's being said in the Gemara itself, but that at least deals with the moral or shkafic issues about why Rav is doing this. Others answer that, like Balei Tosafot, the technical problems, or that he wanted to use it for the yeshiva or for the aniyim, that he had ulterior motives with for the money, and Rav Mari wasn't luckily entitled to it, and therefore he felt there were better purposes, uses for the money. Question of whether Rav Mari was independently wealthy and therefore he didn't need the money. You can give all sorts of explanations, but again, I don't know if any of them really fit into what seems to be the wording of the Gemara, but Rav just seems to be interested in whether he will be or will not be in possession of this money when Yisur Gyura passes away. Mafki la Raviko, Breda Ravami, am I? Why is that the case that there's no halakhic mechanism for get the property from Yisur Gyura to Rav Mari? There is one way that you did not mention, that is the possibility for Yisur Gyura to get the money to his child, Rav Mari. The Lode Isur Dalein Zuzei de Rav Mari Ninhu. Just let Isur admit that this money belongs to his son, Rav Mari. The whole point here of the Hoda'ah is that even though that goes against what we otherwise thought or we otherwise know, the Rishbam emphasized it, the Balei Tosafot emphasized it, that we're muchzakim, that this property belongs to Isur Gyura or belongs to the party, and nevertheless, when they come along and say it belongs to that other party, we believe them, even though there's no evidence to that. There's nothing beforehand that suggests that there was another ownership over here. As soon as you say it, we're going to believe it. Hodak Baldin makes it that we don't question the authority of your statement. You make the statement, we're going to believe you without asking questions. So this is the answer to our question. When you are modeh, what are you doing? Are you able to then transfer the ownership? And in transferring the ownership, successfully do this irrespective of Matnat Shemira? Because remember, there's no Matnat Shemira over here for Yisur Gyura and Rav Mari. They're not in the Parsha of Matnat Shemira. So it has to be that the Hoda is working from the normal mechanism of Hoda, which is Hodat Baldin Kamei Edim Dami. And for that reason, he suggests over here, Rav Yikabrei the Ravami, that that would be a mechanism, Veliknehu Beodita. And he will acquire them through the admission of Yisur Gyura. Rav Mari will take possession of them. How strong that is, whether it means simply that what he's doing is he's Neman, and we were going to carry out his instructions because he admitted to it. Or do we say literally there's a physical kinyan, or the equivalent of a physical kinyan here when he's modeh, and Rav Mari is really in possession of the money? But either way, what you see from the nature of the question is that's the answer to our question, which is, according to the Rishbam, when you give money in Hoda'ah, is that considered to be that you are hiding money or trying to say you're not wealthy, or is it a real gift? Here it's clear that it's a real gift. According to the Balei Tosafot, who said that the question is it functioning like Matnat Shemira, or is it functioning like Hoda'ah? It's clear here that it's functioning like Hoda'ah, not Matnat Shemira. And according to the other explanation brought in the Tosafot, can you gift money through a third party? The answer is yes. The money is sitting with Rava, and Yisur Gyura is able to move the money from Rava to his son, Rav Mari, even though it's not in his possession. So that's the answer to all of our questions. The answer is yes. Adahochi. In the interim, nafak odita mi bei Yisur. All of a sudden, they get word that Yisur admitted that all of his money belongs to Rav Mari. Ikpid Rava. Rava got really upset. Amar kamigamrei tanato linche umafsidili. People are teaching him what to do in order to cause me a loss. What it seems to be is that there was a leak out of the Beit Midrash. The conversation's going in the Beit Midrash, and all of a sudden, right after the question is asked in the Beit Midrash, somebody ran over to Issa Gura and told him to use this claim. And sure enough, he uses the claim, and now Rava's disowned out of all this property, and Rava's upset that someone, in essence, was teaching him what to say in order to disown him from the property. So over here, the Baal Yitosefot raised a very serious issue, which is, Yesh Tema, Lama lo kiyem Rava et Divarav, Va'akaimelon mitzvah l'kayem divrei hamet. Why wasn't Rava willing or open to doing whatever Issa Gura wants? Because there is a mitzvah l'kayem divrei hamet. There is a mitzvah to do whatever the mate has asked you to do. If Issa Gura really wants to get the money to Rav Mari, why is Rava interfering in that? Or why is Rava not helping him to do so? And before he said, I wouldn't do mamach l'shtam, I wouldn't show up. Or if he knows that's the intent, or that's what Issa Gura wants to do, and even if Issa Gura just declares, I want my money to go to my son Rav Mari, that should obligate Rava to give it, because there's a mitzvah, the kayim divrei amet. And so therefore, Tosfot says, I don't understand over here why Rava is doing all of this. The Teretz of Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Meir, again, the Rivam, the Rabbeinu Tam, the Rashbam's brother, says here, Delo amrina mitzvah dekayim divrei amet, elaheched amar tnu manez ze leploni. It's only when you say tnu, when you say the active verb of give it to that person, then that's the case. Elaheched amar manez ze leploni, velo amar tnu, koki ayav na lo amrina mitzvah dekayim divrei amet. That doesn't work to be a mitzvah dekayim divrei amet. So he distinguishes between cases in which you say actively to give this to someone, then we carry out your orders, or there's a mitzvah to follow through on what the maid asks. If the maid simply says, such and such money goes to so-and-so, then that's not necessarily binding as a tzivoy hamit. Part of this is trying to determine when is something called a matnat shchimera, and when is something called mitzvah dekayim divrei hamit. Because they work, first of all, in different manners, and they obligate in different ways. So you could have mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet, or you could have a matnat shchemira. What the Rivam says over here is the difference is how you formulate it. If you formulate it as a command, tnu, then it becomes a mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. On the other hand, if it is just simply, I want so-and-so to have this money, then that's a matnat shchemira. In our case, they would have a big nafkamina. Issa Gura is not in the world of matnat shchemira. He is in the world of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. So therefore, in this case, what the Rivam is suggesting is that the way that he wanted to word it, or the way he did word it, made it that it was functioning like a matnat shchemira, not mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. And then again, Rav is out on a technicality because there is no mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet over here. The Baal Yitosefot discuss that and reject it. And then they give another answer, which is, V'ri teretz, d'olam rinim mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet, aleicha shu biyad shlish. We only have a din of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet when it's sitting with a third party. By the way, that makes it very difficult over here. It is sitting with a third party, or it's exactly the case over here. So the Baal Yitosefot then amend that explanation and say, Umari, shehu shlosh mitchila lekach. It was put in the hands of the trustee, or it was put in the hands of the third party for that specific purpose, to ensure that it gets to the recipient in the end. Because if you don't say that, then this whole case is a proof against that position of the re, which is that when you give it to a third party, you still don't have a requirement of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. Ta'achalu amrina mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet, apagav d'ayah biyad shlish. And so he says that that is the determinant as to whether it's called mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet, is whether you gave it over to a third party for that specific intent. If that's the case, then it's mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. Then he speculates with other possibilities. V'yesh shem mitarzim b'shem Rabbeinu Tam. D'lo amar ata mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet, kevin shro'i l'netein michayim. Since you could grant something while you're alive, then we don't say that it's mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. If he could have done it when he was alive, then why should we have to do it after he passes away? If he could have done it, he should have done it. If he didn't do it, then that doesn't obligate us. V'lo l'netein achar mita. V'achi lo shachvei mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. Since it can't be accomplished after death, and it could have been accomplished beforehand, then we're not going to say, we're not going to invoke the principle of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet. The Baal Yitos would say, v'ein nira l'ri. The Reed says, and he brings proofs to why he thinks that's wrong. V'od. And another answer. Mifareish Rabbeinu Tam, v'lo shayach hacha b'shmaitin mitzvah l'kayim divrei hamet, v'shom d'chol de'ita birusha, ita b'matana, mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit. So Rebbeinu Tam does something interesting over here, which says, this is a nafkamina that I said before, which is that the difference between mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit and matnat shchimira is a question if you're not in the parsha of matnat shchimira, like our case here, where they are not in the world of Yerusha, they're not in the world of matnat shchimira. They should be in the world of mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit. That would be the nafkamina. But the Rebbeinu Tam says, no, mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit also comes from the world of Yerusha, and therefore, if you're not in the world of Yerusha, you're not in the world of Matnat Shchemira, you're not in the world of Mitzvah, the Kayim Divrei Amet. There again, the Tosafot rejects that because it doesn't seem that that is correct. It seems to be that Mitzvah, the Kayim Divrei Amet, is independent of Yerusha. It doesn't function like Yerusha. It's not functioning as a instruction by which there's a matana or a kinyan that is taking place. It's that you're doing or you're trying to accomplish what the mate had in mind, because that's the right thing to do.
It's a chesed to the mate.
Right. Maybe even a chesed to the mate, but that's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. Not because necessarily there's any functional kinyan or gift over here. And then he brings another possibility. Odaya omeri, d'lomrin in mitzvah kayim divereit, ela b'omer lo peh el peh. That's only if he says it face to face to the individual. V'rova lo azal legabei. And Rova never went there. But then he says v'chazer bo'ri. The re backed away from that position. So you see over here, the Bali and Tosafot are trying to figure out where is that line between mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit and matnat shchemira, and what exactly makes something mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit. So we had all these possibilities. You have the Rivam who suggests it has to do with the verbiage, how you say it. You have the Ri who suggests it has to do with putting it in the hands of a third party with a specific intent of getting it to that person. We saw the Rebbeinu Tam who said that it is only if you couldn't accomplish it while you're alive, then there's mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit. Another possibility of the Rebbeinu Tam is that it's connected to Yerusha, and the need to follow through on the tzivoy ha-meit is only true when you're in the parsha of Yerusha. And then we have the Ri who says it's only maybe true when it's peh el peh. So all these different versions, they're all trying to deal with why over here is there no mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meit. Just as an aside, this is one of the mechanisms in the halachic wills today as to how they work. Part of it uses hoda'ah. It uses the mechanism of admission, which says that I admit I owe so-and-so a very large sum of money. But we have an agreement that if this percentage of my assets go to them, that they will waive the outstanding debt that exists. That uses the same mechanism actually in the halachic wills today, which is that the bequeather creates obligations, and those obligations would subsume all the assets of the estate, and in doing so, they encourage the parties there to make payments or to divide the assets up in a certain manner. Because if they don't, then his admission will make it that his obligations now demand that all the assets go to a particular person. So for instance, by a daughter, he could say, I owe my daughter this huge sum of money that far exceeds the value of the estate. But he says that she's one of three. If one third of the assets of the estate are given to her, then she'll waive that outstanding debt. But the only reason there is a debt here, there's no real debt that exists. The debt only exists because you admitted to the fact that there was a debt. So that admission is what generates the legal requirement to pay back the daughter, but it's used as the carrot to incentivize the other parties to divide up the assets, not derech Yerusha, but derech a discharging of the obligations that are generated by the admission of the bequeather. So just as an aside, that is one of the mechanisms that's used today in order to create a halachic will. All right, now, the Gemara says, Shir karka koshu matanato kayemet. Our Mishnah says that if you leave over any small amount of karka, then even if he survives, the matana is permanent because he left over something, which means that he had in mind that he might not die and he might survive. That means that the other gifts are real gifts. Pekama koshu. What's a koshu? Right, koshu usually means any amount. The Gemara here clearly thinks that there's a problem with the koshu, which is that the reasoning behind the koshu here is that he left over property indicates that he thought he might survive. That means there got to be some sort of minimum standard, because if he leaves over a koshu, he's not going to survive on a koshu. So what's that amount? I'm going to review the marav. Karka kidei panasato. It's the karka, the amount that would allow him to survive. Meaning it's karka that would have production that would then make it viable for him to survive if he had no other assets. Your point is well taken. That's why yesterday the Bali Tosafot argued on the Rashbam. I said the Rashbam's explanation is wrong, because karka koshu we see here in the Gemara is defined by kinei parnasato. And therefore Tosafot says when the Rashbam explained the Gemara yesterday is referring to a case of whether this is a koshul being withheld, that's not enough of a koshul. And that's why the Tosfot rejected the Rashbam's explanation of the Gemara yesterday, with regards to the peirot, and whether he owns the place on the tree where the peirot are growing. Rav Yehuda Rava says it's not uniquely about karka, it could even be about metaltalim, as long as it is kedei parnasato. Amar Rabbi Zeira, kama mikuvanan shmatata desave. How good or how aligned are these position of the elders? Karka taimamai. What is the reason by karka that we say that it's considered to be a leftover and therefore the gifts are all gifts? Is the ikoi samechale. Because if he has karka, then he can rely on it. He can use that to sustain himself. Metalta inami, ikoi samechale vayu. So too, if the metalta him around, he will rely on them. In essence, what he is saying is, the same reason you told me that karka has to be kadei parnasato, and that koshu is because the whole thing is reliance on that to survive. If the reasoning is reliance to survive, we should be indifferent between karka and metaltalim, as long as you have sufficient assets to survive on. And therefore you would come to the conclusion that karka koshu doesn't mean koshu, but kadei parnasato. But you also come to the conclusion that it would include metaltalim as well. So very good. Here by the metaltalim, there are those that say that the metaltalim are the same as karka. Just like karka has a yearly production, so too metaltalim can be used to be invested or to do business, and they can generate a profit off of them. So then you would have sufficient assets to, in order to invest, that you can live off the income that is generated from that. All right, so now the Gemara says, Matkifla Rav Yosef, Umay Kavanta. Why are their positions so aligned? Mandamar metaltalin, karkatznan. The one who says that he leaves over metaltalin, it's also considered to be left over. The Mishnah says karka. Mandamar kidei parnasato. The one who says that the amount that you have to leave over is enough to sustain himself on. Koshuhutznan. The Mishnah says koshu. So Rav Yosef says, it might be that your positions are aligned, which is that both of you are coming from the same perspective. And it's true that if one is true, then the other one should be true. That if karka is kadei parnasato, then metaltalin should be equally viable as an option for be considered to be left over. But he says, both of you are mistaken because both of you are against the lashon of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, karka koshu. Karka koshu means karka koshu and not karka of kadei parnasato. It doesn't mean metaltalin. So Rabbi Yosef says, I don't understand why you think that what they're saying is so aligned. They are aligned with each other, but they're not aligned with the Mishnah. Amar alei Abaye, b'chol heiche detanu karka, karka dafko. So Abaye says to his Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef, you're implying here that anytime a Mishnah uses the term karka, it literally means karka, and doesn't mean anything beyond karka, v'atznan. Don't we have a Mishnah in Peah that says, akotei kol nechasav le'abdo, person who writes or gifts all of his assets to his Eved, yatsa ben chorin. He goes free. The Eved is one of the assets of the estate. If the owner then grants him all the assets of the estate, included in all the assets of the estate is he himself. And therefore he acquires himself, and simultaneously with the acquiring himself, he also acquires all the assets of the estate. Shi'er karka koshu. If he leaves over any property, lo yatsa ben chorin. He does not go free. So the way that the Rashbam reads it over here is that when he says shi'er karka koshu, says if he says chutz mi karka, even if he says left out one small piece of karka, then the eved doesn't go free. The Rashbam premises on the idea that an eved has a din like karka. We see many places throughout Shas. The Gemara learns this out from the Psukim at the end of Sefer Vayikra, "V'itnachaltem otam livneichem achareichem," that you pass avadim as property to your children, that avadim kimekarke, that avadim have a din like karka. So here, where he leaves out a portion of karka, we don't know what portion of karka he left out. And maybe he left out that portion which is the eved, or part of the eved. Even if he doesn't do the whole eved, even if he leaves out the smallest portion of the eved is no longer free. If he's not free, he can't take possession of himself, but he also can't take possession of the assets. That's what is problematic here, is that he left over karka. But according to the Rashbam, the reason it's problematic is because you said karka generically. And when you say karka generically, we don't know if it applies to the eved or applies to the other assets. Either way, it causes you a problem. But that means, for the Rashbam, if you specified a particular karka that you were leaving out, you say, I'm gifting you all my assets, with the exception of field number 2. In that case, according to the Rashbam, it should work. Because he didn't leave over anything residual in the Eved himself. Because he made it clear that the karka he was leaving over is this particular tract of land and not the Eved, and therefore it should go through. The Rishbam then goes on to say that it doesn't matter if it's karka kosher that he left over, or even metaltalim that he leaves over, that'll come up in the Gemara in a second, we'll show that that applies to karka, that metaltalim as well. But what you see from here is that the Eved, according to the Rishbam, is in the twilight zone. It's in a limbo state. And Eved has dinim like karka, which are there, it has halachic dinim, like for acquisition, kinyan, yerusha, has a din like karka. But Eved is also, in a real sense, metaltalim. And Eved can move around. It's not real property. It's not stationary. The Eved walks and it moves. So it has a din like metaltalim. And therefore we find that an Eved Kanani has a din like metaltalim and also a din like karka. And therefore the Rishbam says if you leave over a koshu of karka or a koshu of metaltalim, either way, you have now left over something that could possibly be interpreted as being the Eved himself or a portion of the Eved. And therefore the whole thing fails. We're going to see this in a second, but what the Gemara is trying to prove from this is that even though the Mishnah mentions karka, it's not limited to karka. It will also apply if you said metaltalin. And that's what Abaye is trying to prove to Rav Yosef, that just because the Mishnah says karka does not always mean that it is karka exclusively and not metaltalin. On the other hand, the Bali of Tosafot, based on the Yerushalmi and the Tosef, to say that that's not the problem over here. The problem is that we don't say palgin and dibura inside of a shtar. If you have a shtar that says that I'm giving away all my property, chutz mizu, with the exception of this item. Now, when you do the exception of this item, that leaves out something in the gift. That leaving out something in the gift, we don't say that he left out only the karka, but he didn't leave out the evet or a portion of the evet. Once he leaves something out in the document itself, that makes it as if there was something left over in the entirety of what's gifted in that document. So even though he says, listen, I'm giving away all my possessions to my Eved, with the exception of field number 2. So when he writes that in the shtar, we would have said, okay, as far as all the assets are concerned and the Eved's concerned, they got everything. It's just that one field that's left out. If that's the case, the Eved should have been able to acquire himself. What the Bali Tosafot would say, based on the Yerushalmi and the Tosefta, is that we don't say palgin and dibura by a shtar. In a shtar, if there's something left over residual in the shtar, that residual or leftover impacts on the entire shtar. And so therefore, when he left over the field, that means that he withheld something, and that withholding affects the ability of the Eved to take possession of himself, even though the asset was specified. Against what the Rashbam is saying over here, where the Rashbam says if you specify the asset, it won't impact. Over here, even for the Bali Tosafot, whether he says karka kolshu, or he says karka zo, or this karka in particular, both of those are considered to be a residual, and therefore it's not deemed to be a sefer kritut anymore. It's not considered to be a release or a document of emancipation for the Eved. The Tosafot says over here, perish, afil yiskir behedja, mashem motzim in a shichrur. Even he explicitly states where he's living out, dazesh lanu lomar, shalosh shichrur Eved, afilu hochi, Kana nechasim v'nishtachel de palginan dibura. Lao de rabbonin de poligalei itleho de lo palginan dibura. From that, it sounds like that the issue for the rabbonin, who we're reading now here, is that they were not palginan dibura. So now, Rabbi Shimon Omer, lo olam hu ben chorin. It does work. Ad shiomar kol nechsai netunim leploni avdi chutz miachad ribo sheben. That all my possessions go to so-and-so, with the exception of 1/10,000th of them. So in the way that the Rashbam reads it is that the problem, according to Rabbi Shimon in this case, is that when you left out 1/10,000th, we don't know what that 1/10,000th is. Is that 1/10,000th of your field? Is that 1/10,000th of the Eved? We don't know, and therefore the Eved can't go free because you left over something that could be read or deemed to be the Eved himself. By the way, the Rashbam reads that the Rambam in the Parashat Mishnayot over there says that when you say I'm leaving out 1/10,000th, it means that I'm leaving out 1/10,000th of everything in the document or all of my possessions. That means that of every item or every asset in the estate, I'm leaving out 1/10,000th. If you do that, then by definition, the Eved's not going to go. It's not a safek as to whether he's referring to the Eved or something else. It's simply that he left out 1/10,000th, and that means he left over something of the Eved, and therefore he can't go free, because otherwise you have to explain why he would be referring to the Eved, even though the Eved is worth much more than that. He says, I'm leaving out 1/10,000th, the Eved is worth so much more than that, why would he be referencing the Eved? So Rashi in Gitin says it's independent of the value of the Eved. Irrespective of that, the 1/10,000th he can say is, in my eyes, he's worth 1/10,000th. Even though his market value is higher, in my eyes, that's what he's worth, and therefore it's considered to be a residual. For the Rambam, it's simply that you left out a portion of all the assets of the estate, including the Eved, and that portion that makes it impossible to go free, because you can't go free unless he gets 100% of himself in order to go free. The Rashbam, who says that for the Tanakhama, The reason is because Eved is considered like Karkor Lerbitaltuin, and when you leave it out, we suspect that that might be a reference to the Eved. Rabbi Shimon says, no. When you specify Karkor Lerbitaltuin, it's clearly you're not speaking about the Eved. When you generically say I'm leaving something out, that's when you have a problem. That's the way the Rishpam would explain it. According to the Balei Tosafot, the machloket here is whether we're Pogin and Dibura or not Pogin and Dibura. When we go ahead and say that I'm leaving out a portion of the Karkor, do we say that when you leave out a portion of the Karkor, it means that now I have somehow left out a part of this whole emancipation document, and therefore the document fails as a get shechur for the Eved? That's what the Rabbonon think. That way, if you leave out Karkor, Metalto, and anything out of it, we say that it impedes the ability of the Eved to go free. Whereas Rabbi Shimon says that that's not true. Pogin Dibura. As far as the Eved is concerned, he gave away everything. He gave him his full rights. Karka? Okay, so we withheld some of the karka. That's the karka. That's not the Eved. You can separate between them. On the other hand, if you say, chutz me'achad miriboshalan, that means you withheld on everything in the, like the Rambam says, you withheld on everything in the contract. And that means that you have a residual that is being withheld even in the Eved himself. And that's the way that you will explain it according to the Balei Tosafot. Amar Rav Dimi Bar Yosef, Amar Rav Elazar, asu metaltalim shiur eitz leved, that they made metaltalim to be considered a shiur eitz leved. Or in essence, when the Chachamim said before, shiur karka koshu, what Rav Dimi Bar Yosef, Amar Rav Elazar says is that metaltalim have the same din as karka. If you left over a residual of metaltalim, it would work the same way that a residual of karka. For the Rashbam, that means sometimes an evidence called metaltalim, sometimes an Eved is called Karka, so it would work in both ways. Going to Balei Tosafot, when you have residual in the contract, that already, we don't say Pogin and Dibura, we don't split it up, and that means there's a residual that's in ruining to get Shechru over here. It doesn't matter if it's Karka, it doesn't matter if it's Metaltalim. Velo, asu Metaltalim, Shiur Etzel Ktuba. But that's not true by Ktuba. That we already saw earlier in the Masechta, that if a husband gifts to his wife property amongst the children, he's distributing property to each of his children, and then he distributes a parcel of property to his wife. If his wife accepts that property and doesn't say anything at the time, forfeiting the lien on the remaining property that were given away to the children at that point in time. That's a halacha that we saw earlier. Over there, the Gemara qualified it and said that's only true by karka. But if he gave away metalkalim to his wife, those metalkalim don't ruin her lien on the entire estate. With her tuba, she has a right or a lien on the entire estate. We said over there, if he gifts her karka and then gifts karka to the other children in front of her, and she doesn't say anything, that means she's waiving her lien on the properties that are going to the children. That's only true by karka. If he gifts her metalkalim and gives property to the karka, her lien is still extant, and she hasn't waived her lien because it's only if she receives karka. And that's what it means here. That over there, they didn't make metalkalim like karka. What you see from this is that sometimes karka koshu does not mean karka, it means even metalkalim. That's what Abai is trying to prove to Rabbi Yosef. Says, no, hota medinu delo dine karka. Rabbi Yosef says back there, no. In that Mishnah, they shouldn't have written karka. Vaidi the tani resha, but because of parallel structure between the resha and the seifa, that's why they wrote karka and the seifa. Because the resha required that it definitely be karka. Because in the Reisha it says, Rabbi Kiva Omer, Karka Koshu, when you have Karka Koshu, Chayevet Bepeya, Bibi Kurim, V'lichtov Aleihem Pruzbo, V'lichnotim Em Nechasim She'en Lehem Achrayut, Bekesev B'Shtar B'Chazaka. So in the Reisha of that Mishnah, which we actually quoted earlier in the Masechta, over there you have Karka Koshu helps for certain halachic issues. First of all, any amount of Karka is Chayav in Peya. The requirement for giving Peya is even in the smallest portion of Karka. Number two is by Bikurim. The requirement to bring up Bikurim, you need Karka Koshu, which means that you need to own the land. It has to be your land. Any amount of land that you own would be sufficient for you to bring up the Bikurim. In addition to that, Pruzbol, the institution of Pruzbol in the Gemara and Gittin, over there the Gemara says that they did it a la Karka. It's only if the Lovet, if the debtor has Karka, can you write a Pruzbol. The Rishonim deal with why that is, but the Rashbam here brings the reason that's mentioned by many of the Rishonim is because we view it as if it is a mashkon then. The karka is a mashkon, and it's as if collected then. A outstanding loan that has a mashkon, then Shemitah Ksafim does not affect it, because they look at it as if collected, and there's no longer a fear of lo yigos, or the restriction of pressuring the debtor to pay back. You don't have to pressure him, because you have collateral that will protect you. Since you have collateral, we don't worry about you pressuring him, and that's exempt from Shemitah. So what the Chachamim did then was simulate that effect through Karka. By using the Karka as a Mashkon, then you could say that that's how Pruzbol works. Others suggest that Pruzbol just works. It's the institution of the Chachamim, and that it's given over to Beit Din, and Beit Din becomes the collection agency and not you. But here the Rashbam gives that reasoning as to associating it with Karka Koshil. Those Rishonim who believe that that's not the reason just say that the reason they say Karka Koshil is because that's the mainstream type of loan. People who lend without underlying karka for the debtor are not making mainstream loans. They are making risky loans that in all likelihood would have been lost, and therefore we're not going to protect them. If they lent when there's karka for the debtor and he's protected by karka, that's a mainstream loan, and then that's subject to the gzeira or the takana of Prusbol. The Lord Kotman Nechasim, that's what we said before, Kinyan Agav. To be kone karka through kesef shtar and chazaka, which are the mechanisms of kinyan from the Gemara and Kiddushin for karka, through those mechanisms of kinyan, you can acquire the karka and other metaltalin along with it, a kinyan agav. And here we say that it could be karka koshu. Any amount of karka can generate the kinyan agav. It doesn't have to be in relationship to the metaltalin. You have tons of metaltalin, and it still will work as a kinyan agav. There, the Gemara in Kedushin asked that question. Does a kinyan agav have to be able to facilitate that the metaltalin could sit on the karka or not sit on the karka? From this Mishnah, it would sound like you don't have to get the metaltalin on the karka. There, the Gemara answers, oh, maybe it's a very expensive jewel that he's putting on the karka koshu. And maybe that's why it's a kinyan agav over there. But anyway, that is the kinyan agav word karka koshu. Over here, the Rashbam mentioned something that we already discussed earlier, is that the girsa in this Mishnah should not include vidui meiser. Vidui meiser is not something that requires that you own karka, even though the psukim over there say, veta damar shenatata lanu. In vidui meiser, it says the land that you have given to us. And we say by bikurim that you have to have land in order to bring the bikurim, because over there it says, Reshit pri adama shenatata li. So then it sounds like it's karka or adama that was given to me. So the Rishbam says, well, by vidui meiser it says, et adama shenatata lanu. So it sounds like there you also need karka. So the Rishbam here answers, and we discussed it in the Bali Tosafot earlier, that et adama shenatata lanu, that lanu, it doesn't mean that you need to have personal ownership of property. It just has to mean, as Klal Yisrael as a whole, the property in Klal Yisrael as a whole, or you have to be ra'oi, huva v'tavito chilek baritz, that you have to be ra'oi to take a portion in the land. That's it. You don't have to personally own the property, because it's speaking about property of Klal Yisrael in general. So you just have to be someone who could have been an owner of property or been a mechalek baritz. So if you're a ger, obviously that wouldn't work. But otherwise, you would qualify even if you don't own land personally. And therefore, he says, vidui meiser should not be included. But then, because of that, mishum achik tani karka, for that reason, it wrote karka in the Yosefa. Because the Reisha was saying karka koshu and mean it literally karka koshu, that's the din of Rabbi Akiva. In the Seifa of the Mishnah, even though there it could have been metaltalin and not karka, it wrote karka for literary style to have a parallel structure. But that, Rabbi Yosef says, that's not a proof that when you write karka, it doesn't literally mean karka, it could mean metaltalin. That's a unique case, because of parallel structure you put it in, and that's obvious from the fact that the first part of the Mishnah says karka, and it means karka literally. So the second half of the Mishnah put in karka, even though it doesn't mean it literally. In our case over here, our Mishnah has no reason to write karka instead of metaltalin, if metaltalin would work. And then if I have to take it at face value, that it's only karka is considered a shiur, and not metaltalin. Okay, we're going to stop over here, 9 lines down on Kuf Nun, Amud Aleph, and tomorrow we're going to discuss the other thing, which is it always true when the Mishnah says koshu, it literally means koshu.